talking about the canonical loop quantum gravity. I was thinking long what motto to select for this talk, and I found the following in my old transparencies. So you may believe or not that this is true, but well, okay, what is true is that indeed the following phrase was spelled out by somebody famous long time ago, and well, it's not completely not true. Okay, so I will start with reminding what tools we use in loop quantum gravity. Next, I will go back to the issue of actually pure gravitational field and how one can quantize pure gravity with loop quantum gravity framework. And next, we will pass to another example, which is gravity coupled to one scalar field. However, we'll consider a couple of scalar fields. So there will be also example of non-rotating dust, which is familiar to Vikar Hussain and Tomek Pawłowski. And also there will be also example of massless scalar field. And I will explain to you what this means, which is probably now very confusing. And I will also, in this example, I will tell you how we can construct observables, which will illustrate the framework of loop quantum gravity. Okay, so let us start with general setup. In terms of the Ashtekar variables, canonical gravity is described by the Ashtekar variables themselves, Ashtekar-Barbero connection and triad. And in addition to this, suppose that we have some fields. I will not discuss fermions, so these are just scalar fields, and in examples which I will consider, it will be just a single real scalar field. In addition to this, we have two Laplace functions, and a theory typically is defined by some constraints. So there is the scalar constraint, there is the vector constraint. If we are doing just ADM, then that would be all as far as the constraints following from gravity are concerned. However, because we are using frames, there is still one more constraint, which mathematically is the same, has the same form as Young-Mills constraint. However, this constraint is generates rotations of this orthonormal frame. In addition to this, if those fields, in case those fields are some gauge fields, there may be some other constraints which come with those extra fields. So when we deal with constraints, those constraints are of the first class. So I mean, here I'm very general, so I cannot say that a priori that they really, but they are. There may come some other constraints, but at least as far as those constraints following from GR are concerned, they are of the first class. So our aim is to, when we do physics, we should consider Dirac observables. That means functions of fields which Poisson commute with all the constraints. By C, I mean not only the scalar constraint, but I also mean the vector constraint and by the Gauss constraint. Okay, so loop quantum gravity consists in using very specific variables. So we parameterize the space of the Ashtekar connections by parallel transports. So for every curve in the Cauchy surface of initial data, given a connection variable, we define the parallel transport, and we consider this parallel transport as more fundamental object than the connection itself. So we try to formulate everything in terms of those parallel transports. On the other hand, for every to have a counterpart, a function which depends on on the triad. So since triad is mathematically maybe sort of as three differential two forms, it's natural to integrate a two form along a two surface. So, and this is called flux. So for triads, we have the three frames, three frame elements, and for each of them we have one flux. Or instead, we can smear this field against a test function. So here we'll have this, for generality, this test function. So those two variables, they replace A and E. A and E have the canonical Poisson bracket, just the product of delta functions. Those variables, they have a nice Poisson bracket. The delta function is actually exhausted, and there is no delta, and actually this Poisson bracket is finite. So those variables define if we use Poisson bracket Lie algebra, and when we want to, so now when we want to quantize, the most naive way of quantization is that we will that our states will be functions of connections, that we will have some measure in the space of connections, and that our momentum conjugate to A, that it will be just the functional derivative. However, the corresponding operator should be well defined in this Hilbert space. It turns out that it is possible. So we consider functions of connections which have specific form, namely functions which depend on connection only through some parallel transports. So if a function can be written as some other function of n parallel transports along n curves like this, then we call it cylindrical, and then we and such functions, we choose such functions to construct quantum states. Actually, this decomposition is not unique. A function, if it is written in this way, it can be also written by in terms of different parallel transports and in terms of a different function in equivalent way. So this decomposition is not unique. So whatever we do, it has to be independent on the choice of decomposition. And this independence we call cylindrical consistency. So for instance, if we want to define a measure, we need to find a measure, a way to integrate this function, and another way to integrate this function. However, they have to coincide. Those measures have to coincide, so the integrals have to give the same number. And if they do, then we can promote this to an integral defined actually on this uniquely. So in this way, cylindrically consistent measures defined measures or integrals of on the space of functions, and we can take the space of squared integrable functions and consider this a Hilbert space of our states. So this is like in quantum mechanics, we have our Hilbert space is space of square integrable functions of x or xyz. Here it is the space of square integrable functions of this form. When we construct operators acting on those functions, again, one of possible ways of constructing is to define for each collection of curves, which we call graph, is to find an operator which is well defined on functions on parallel transports on this graph. However, those operators have to satisfy this property that if we take two functions, different functions on different graphs, which happen to define the same function as a function of A, then those operators should also have the same action, and then we can define unambiguously an operator acting on function on the space of connections, and so cylindrically consistent operators define operator on a function of connections. So actually, these days we don't bring up this notion of cylindrical consistency any longer because we have a nice basis in this Hilbert space. This is basis which consists of spin networks, and having basis, we don't need to to do this. However, people doing spin forms often discuss issue of cylindrical consistency or bring up the cylindrical consistency as a new extra condition. So it's good to know where it is coming from. So that's why I recalled this old notion. Now, one can, so in this way, we actually quantized our Poisson, our kinematic variables. We can look at this from a more educated point of view. We can say that there is some actually abstract star algebra, which is defined in this way that we consider each variable as element of this algebra. We replace the Poisson bracket by 1 upon I h bar commutator between those elements. There are a couple of other natural relations which are satisfied by those classical variables. So we also enforce that those relations will be satisfied by the elements of this algebra. Then at the end, we have a star algebra. And now our goal is to find a diffeomorphism invariant state. And we have a theorem that there is a unique diffeomorphism invariant state on this algebra. And this state can be written in terms of the integral, which was on the previous transparency, in this way, which is explained here. So if there is element of algebra which is of the form something times E on the right-hand side, then the action of this state is zero. And if this is just a function of several parallel transports, then this is our integral. So in this way, we found this state by at this transparency. And here there is another information that actually is a unique state, which is diffeomorphism invariant. Those variables have some funny properties, which I don't think we really understand well, or if we exhausted all properties of which are that they don't commute, that things which were variables which were a priori commuting before, because they were like position or like momentum variables, they don't commute any longer when we define fluxes. We control this. We know how they commute, but they don't commute. So we know the commutation new commutation relation, but it is some sort of by introducing distributional variables, we introduce some anomaly, and it's not clear how important this anomaly is for loop quantum gravity. Another remark is that when you look for diffeomorphisms given a star algebra, when you look for and some symmetry group, you may look for a state on this algebra which is invariant with respect to this symmetry group. However, you may also relax your assumption, and you may say that you look for representations of this algebra which are covariant with respect to the action of the symmetry group, but which are not given by a state. So still there is this possibility, which is not completely exhausted, that there may be other representations of our holonomies and fluxes which don't admit a single invariant state. Okay, so now what we can do? We can, with those variables, we can define operators in the Hilbert space. So this is a very general scheme, which of course doesn't contain all the details, and very often there can be some departures from this scheme. But given a function, which is a function of E of the Ashteka variables, I distinguished the curvature of this variable A. So given a function, when we want to turn it into an operator, then what we do, we first write this function as a function of a bunch of parallel transports and fluxes. And in particular, if there is this curvature, Then we replace curvature by difference between parallel transports along closed loops. And then those fluxes and holonomies are easily replaced by operators. So in this way, we obtain an operator. But now the problem is to do it in such a way that we typically, this is a sort of discretized approximate function which approximates this function. But now the difficulty is to do it in such a way that when this function approximates, it goes to this function, that at the same time the corresponding operator has some well-defined limit. Then, and this limit should also have nice properties, like should be diffeomorphism invariant. In some cases, when we introduce this operator, we actually introduce this operator, instead of introducing on the kinematical Hilbert space, we introduce this operator on space of diffeomorphism invariant distributions defined on this kinematical Hilbert space. So then our condition is that the dual operator defines a limit. So if I take a diffeomorphism invariant distribution and act with this distribution on vectors in some domain of my Hilbert space, if I apply this operator, I would like this thing to admit a limit. So I want this operator to be well defined, not as an operator acting on the right hand side, but as an operator acting on the left hand side. And the left hand side is a diffeomorphism invariant distribution. So diffeomorphism invariant distributions are solutions to the vector constraints. So sometimes we introduce those operators directly on kinematical Hilbert space. Sometimes we first solve diffeomorphism constraint and we introduce operators on solutions to diffeomorphism constraint, vector constraint, and then this is what we do here. We have also a couple of other tricks which were invented. For instance, there is so-called Tiemann's trick, which consists in this, that when we have 1 upon square root of something which goes to 0, and we are not happy that this will be singular when this is 0, we replace it by Poisson bracket of suitable Poisson bracket with square root, which actually produces this 1 upon square root, and then we quantize this rather than this. Now, the advantage of this, of the loop framework, is that actually we don't encounter infinities. So in our formulae, there are no epsilons explicitly written. There are just, we just split space, we divide space into small cells and do integrals along three-dimensional regions or two-dimensional surfaces or along one-dimensional curves, but without any explicit epsilon. And then we collect this products and sums of such operators, and if the result is well defined, then there is no epsilon we have to worry about, so somehow naturally we avoid all the infinities which usually are present in case of quantization. So what do we obtain in this way? There is area operator, which we define in this way. So area operator is defined for a two surface. And when a curve intersects this surface and a cylindrical function depends on parallel transport along this curve, then the area operator actually acts on this variable corresponding to this curve, and we can diagonalize this operator. So the eigenvalues of this operator have this form, and we can, in this way, we can choose for every curve eigenvectors of this operator, and it gives us the composition of the kinematical Hilbert space into eigen vectors of some area operators. And this decomposition has this advantage that it is orthogonal, and those spaces are actually finite dimensional. So if we fix eigenvalues of this area operator, then the corresponding Hilbert space is finite dimensional. Volume, there's another typical operator, which is the volume operator, and this volume operator, it actually is sensitive on what happens at intersections of those curves which define a cylindrical function. Now, those J's, in fact, they label irreducible representations of SU2, and they have something to do with the gauge transformations. But we remember that among the constraints which we have to solve, there is a Gauss constraint, the Gauss constraint, which generates the Gauss gauge transformations. So if you want to solve this constraint, then it's equivalent to saying to assuming that functions, I mean solutions to this constraint are gauge invariant functions. So we have to look in this decomposition for such functions which, in addition to being elements of this Hilbert space, are gauge invariant with respect to those transformations. And gauge invariance amounts to some to intertwining the representations assigned to those curves at every intersection points, to intertwining them to trivial representation. So if we impose the Gauss constraint, then it is the same as selecting from our Hilbert space only those states which are given by those irreducible representations, but also intertwined by some invariants of those representations. And those states are called spin network states, and they were completely independently introduced by Penrose long time ago in some other context, and later they were, after we introduced this framework, they were again brought up by Rovelli and Smolin, and Baez and some of us found how to construct from them an orthonormal basis in our Hilbert space. Okay, now the next constraint is a diffeomorphism constraint. So in case when we do pure gravity, then if there were fermions, then we would not insist on gauge invariance. We would take into account also fermions. But if we do pure gravity, then we have to solve this Gauss constraint. And then the diffeomorphism constraint means that we want to find diffeomorphism invariant elements of our kinematical Hilbert space. But this group is not compact, so we don't expect those diffeomorphism invariant states to be really normalizable elements of this Hilbert space. They are defined as some distributions which are diffeomorphism invariant, and we have an exact definition how to construct such diffeomorphism invariant distributions by averaging with respect to diffeomorphism. So we take a cylindrical function, and there is some definition how to average this function with respect to diffeomorphisms, and the result is a diffeomorphism invariant distribution which is defined on some domain of our kinematical Hilbert space. Those distributions, they are considered as half physical states because they satisfy diffeomorphism constraint, and for them we define a new a scalar product, and with the scalar product they set a Hilbert space. So we have, so first we define the kinematical Hilbert space. Now we have a Hilbert space of solutions to the diffeomorphism constraint. Now. So now we still stick to pure gravity. So we have already solved the Gauss constraint by choosing intertwiners in intersections of curves along which we have parallel transports. We have already solved the vector constraint by this procedure of averaging and constructing diffeomorphism invariant distributions and defining a scalar product between those distributions. Now we face the most difficult part, which is the scalar constraint. So we start with the Hilbert space of solutions to the Gauss-Young-Mills constraint, to the vector constraint. And we, in this space, we would like to impose the scalar constraint. OK, and actually, there is a nice way in which we can pass those operators which are defined in the kinematical Hilbert space and are invariant with respect to the Gauss and vector constraint. Those operators naturally induce operators on this space of solutions. So this space comes with, for instance, the total volume of operator is also well defined in this space. So we would like to define the scalar constraint operator, quantum scalar constraint operator, also in this space as well defined operator. Now, classically, scalar constraint is real, so the corresponding operator should be self-adjoint. Okay. However, this operator doesn't preserve this space because it is assigned to a point x and it breaks the diffeomorphism invariance. So there is no obvious mathematical way to require that it is self-adjoint. And this is a small technical problem, but this problem actually stimulated several different approaches. So for instance, there is an old model by Rovelli and Smolin, in which I will go back to this later. Actually, there should be two here, I'm sorry. And in this model, instead of defining this operator, we define integral of the square root of this, or with 2, which in this case that doesn't change the result. And we look for so such operator is diffeomorphism invariant that it will preserve our Hilbert space. So it makes sense to define this operator such that it is self-adjoint. Okay, so the idea is to define this operator and such that it is self-adjoint, and then define eigenvectors to be solutions to the scalar constraint. Another approach is which was introduced by Tiemann, and it was called the master constraint program, which was to consider such expression. In each case, the idea is that if this is zero, then it implies that integrand is zero at every point, because this is a positive definite expression. So the idea of master constraint program was to consider such expression instead of this expression. However, and then again, consider the vectors of the zero eigenvalue of this as solutions to the scalar constraint. There is an unexplored thus far approach, which is actually to define a new Hilbert space, which will be given by solutions to vector constraint, however with shift function vanishing at a given point x. And then we can, for such Hilbert space, we can actually define this operator as a self-adjoint operator. We can solve this equation. And now, and next, from such solutions, we can, in terms of those solutions, we can construct a solution of this in the space of solutions to with all shift functions. But in this way, so this is a scheme how we can actually define those solutions to pure gravity without either master constraint or this. Okay, so now there is a progress in constructing of this operator, of the scalar constraint operator. Namely, this operator consists of two pieces. One piece looks like looks in this way, and this was this operator is defined by Tiemann a long time ago. Recently, Antonia Zipfel and Emanuele Alessi were studying properties of this operator, and they understood a lot. I don't know if there's any talk about this, but you can find in the literature some new results, new technical results concerning properties of this operator. There is another new result, which is the following. So there is old formula by Barbero, in terms of which we can write a scalar constraint as in such a form that this is this form, this is this term FEE minus a Ricci scalar. And Ricci scalar of three-dimensional metric depends only on this frame. So this operator is already quantized, but we don't have this operator. So the new result by Alessia Sanyoussi is a derivation of this operator. This there will be Mehdi's talk, and he will tell you. So with this, we actually have a compact formula for the scalar constraint operator. And this scalar constraint operator has similar properties as operator in loop quantum cosmology, which means it adds a loop, it annihilates a loop, or it it doesn't change a graph. Now, another example, nice, is loop quantization is gravity coupled to a scalar field. So if you couple gravity to scalar field, then typically you can solve the scalar constraint in the following way. That momentum of this scalar field is a given function of gravitational degrees of freedom. If it was a massive scalar field, then this function would also depend on the field itself, and then it is more difficult example. But there are cases in which it doesn't. So one example is non-rotating dust. This example was studied by Tomek Pawłowski and Vikar Hussain. And in this case, this right-hand side is just the gravitational scalar constraint. This solution for scalar constraint of coupled theory becomes P equals the gravitational scalar constraint. Another example is massless scalar field. In this case, this function depends on point of phase space. So for a positive momentum, there is plus sign here. For negative, there is minus. And depending on whether momentum is bigger or gradient of scalar field, then we have here either plus or minus. So for instance, for a homogeneous universe, momentum is bigger than gradient. So we have this case. And if we are far from homogeneous universe, far in phase space, then we have this case. So what we need to quantize such theory, we have additionally to quantize the scalar field, but this is also quantization is available. So we have a Hilbert space, which is we call this polymer quantization, and this is different quantization than in field theory, quantum field theory, but it's compatible with the loop quantization. So here the starting point is for the kinematical space, we take this kinematical space of loop quantum gravity times this polymer Hilbert space of scalar field. Here we, again, as I explained in the case of pure gravity, we implement this averaging by diffeomorphisms. In this way, we obtain a space of diffeomorphisms invariant distributions on this space. Now the second task is to define such an operator where this H is the H from the previous transparency. And now the statement is that if we succeed to define this operator, then elements of this space which have this form with this function small psi being independent of the scalar field, so this function small psi, it is an element of this space, but it depends only on gravitational degrees of freedom, then this gives us the general solution of the scalar constraint written in suitable way. So all work amounts to defining this operator. And actually, in the case of Pawłowski-Hussain, this is a single operator. In case of massless scalar field, we have four operators. So because there were those those ambiguities. Okay, so what do? We suppose that we have those four operators, then we have for each choice of pluses and minuses, we have one solution to scalar constraint corresponding to a different region in the phase space, and all those solutions are normalizable elements of a single Hilbert space. So here we have a single Hilbert space, normalizable elements, so we don't have to define new physical scalar product. This is just the old physical scalar product. All we have to do is we have to define Dirac observables, but the most general Dirac observable is easy to be written. It has to, so if we take a solution, this, so we construct this observable in this way that we take arbitrary operator, which actually depends only on gravitational degrees of freedom. I didn't write it here. And from this operator, we define an operator which acts on this part, on this factor psi. And this gives us a well-defined operator acting on the space of solutions, and those this map has this property that it preserves the product, so it's a nice map. So, but here there is the technical problem, namely, our task amounts to quantizing not only the scalar constraint but also to the vector constraint, and this is the most difficult thing. I think that Madhavan Varadarayan may be talking about this in his plenary talk. However, we have only to define this operator, the action of this operator on this diffeomorphism invariant state of gravitational degrees of freedom, and now we can assume some that we do it in a different way, namely that we first gauge fix and solve classical constraints and then quantize. See what one would obtain in that case, and then require that we obtain the same. So we have two schemes of quantization. What I was talking about here is that we first define quantum constraint operators and then solve them. But there is another way which we didn't discuss here, which is that we first solve classical constraints and impose gauge conditions and then quantize. So one can require that the two procedures give the same result. So if we require this, then we obtain the following inequality. On one hand side, we have our operator which we want to find. On the other hand, this is what we would obtain by the second procedure. So now by comparing, we can see that we can obtain this from this by choosing the factor ordering in this expression such that the vector constraint operators, whatever they are always on the right-hand side, because then they will be killing this guy, and if we remove those vector constraints then operators, then we obtain exactly this. So this is telling us what to do for those solutions which correspond to the case when a momentum of the field, scalar field, dominates versus the gradient. And perhaps something similar can be done in the other sectors, and I don't know what it should be. Here I just want to tell you that we still need to know how to construct diffeomorphism observables. There are not many available provided by loop quantum gravity. However, Jędrzej Świerzewski will tell you about some new ideas how to construct such observables. Okay, so I told you how to quantize. I showed you how to quantize, use loop quantum gravity to quantize gravitational field coupled to scalar field. I considered two cases. One was Hussain Pawłowski, another one was massless scalar field. It seems that this case of massless scalar field has additional advantage, namely, in case of a massless scalar field, we have the Hamiltonians strongly commute classically. So it means that when we quantize, all we have to ensure is that the corresponding operators also commute. In the case of Hussain Pawłowski, actually those guys are gravitational generators of the they are just ADM scalar constraints, and they don't commute. So in this case, it's a little more different. But this is discussion, so you can always stop discussion whenever you want.
Questions?
Jurek, I just had a small comment.
Yeah.
One of the transparencies you raised is interesting point about the Poisson bracket of two flux operators, which is classically you might think naively it is zero, but it's not zero.
No, classically it's not zero. Already classically it is not zero.
Naively you might think it is zero, but it is not.
Right.
It is the Jacobian is not.
Right, here.
Mark Geyer told me, and other people here may know, that there is a paper, which is in which people actually define a gauge invariant operator, E. In other words, take a point, and then this E is defined as by transporting.
Yeah, this is what we also sometimes do. And then they commute?
And then the statement, no, they don't. They then the statement that they recover what we have.
Then they classically do not.
Whose work is this?
I mean, this is an old argument, but actually it was first shown by Thomas Thiemann.
Thomas has done just recently.
I think.
But what is the statement?
Computed algebra.
Oh. But what is the statement?
What is that? You can classically define ESF, which is in a gauge covariant manner, because
right, we transport all of them to, we add some extra loops
then the
and transport.
You actually calculate the Poisson bracket, and then the Poisson bracket is exactly what we had.
So this is
arrived at from the point of view of.
So then only non-commutation comes from the fact that we use A and E and E's themselves.
So there's an understanding of that. Nice.
So this is QSD7 actually.
Is it right? It's already that. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, the paper syntactic structures or something.
Thank you.
Just a comment about this gauge covariant version of E. There's such an object that is a Dirac observable in BF theory. And I wrote that down in 91.
I wanted to ask a fast question. What is the perspective on the different meta couplings? Are you looking for, the unique meta coupling?
In this case, we used for quantization of scalar field, we used the polymer quantization, and it seems that this polymer quantization is distinguished. For the massless scalar field, so quantization of massless scalar field and gravity works very well with polymer quantization. But if we introduce mass term or potential, then polymer quantization breaks. So I think that this is the polymer quantization which should be. So the answer is that we should adjust the quantization of the scalar field to. The form of the Hamiltonian of the scalar field. That is my guess.
Okay, so let's thank you again. The next one is on quantum matter and quantum space time.
When you show the times, is it out of 15 minutes or 20 minutes?
15 plus 25.
Yeah, but when you show, like, say...
And this is 15, okay. Just out. We are late already.
Hello. I'll be talking about quantum matter and quantum space-time, which is related to the talks that you probably heard yesterday, in particular by Orian Martin and Ed Wilson-Ewing, and partly related to what Jurek just said. So let me just refresh what we learned about quantum corrections, especially in cosmological context. Anomaly-free quantum corrected effective equations exist, and they have non-trivial deformation of constraint algebra. We also learned that we cannot fix gauge prior to quantization, and we cannot quantize matter without simultaneously quantizing spacetime. Both of these would lead to inconsistent equations of motion. Now, in cosmology, it's nice to define some observables to make connection with observations, which is not always trivial. For example, if you want to define quantum-corrected density, it's tricky. So it's nice to have some starting point, some fundamental primary statement. And in this talk, I'll dance from conservation of energy as such statement. And here is my motivation why. Even classically, conservation laws are related to space-time symmetries, and it's manifest, for example, through Hamilton's equation, especially classical ones, where momentum operator generates space translations and energy operator generates time translations. In general relativity, we have local energy conservation, which has to do with local space-time symmetries, and that's related to general covariance. Now, if we have quantum corrections, that may affect the structure of space-time or the form of energy conservation. And this is what I'm going to discuss today. And here is the plan. I'll start with the covariant formulation of energy conservation, then we'll translate that into canonical language and discuss what quantum corrections would do to the conservation law. So this is the standard conservation of energy equation. Divergence of stress energy tensor should vanish, where stress energy tensor is defined through the matter action, and the connection gamma is related to metric. And again, for simplicity, I'll just focus on the nu equals zero equation, and that simplifies to this. Now, how do we translate that into to canonical variables? We start with the standard ADM decomposition. We split metric into lapse function, shift vector, and the spatial metric, H and HAB. We can also go further and introduce triad, but for the purpose of today's talk, this is sufficient. And then we also do Legendre transform the action that gives rise to constraints and Poisson brackets. For example, for scalar field, this is how we can rewrite the matter action. So the curly variables designate Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism densities, and the straight H is the total Hamiltonian constraint, which includes both. Let me just remind you how metric components look as expressed in terms of lapse shift and spatial metric. These are the covariant components, the contravariant ones. We also need determinant. And we'll consider variations of the metric components, which are clearly related to the variations of lapse shift and spatial metric. Right here. So with these ingredients, we can expand the matter action. We can see the variation of the matter action. First, this is just basically the definition of the stress energy tensor. And then we can explicitly break the summation into temporal and spatial indices. Yeah, I probably didn't tell that. Mu, the Greek indices run from 0 to 3. Latin indices run from 1 to 3. Then we can collect the terms with lapse variation, shift variation, and spatial metric variation, take functional derivatives with respect to them. Those would be related to some combinations of the stress energy components, and then we can invert the equations, solve for the stress energy components, and get these equations, which relate functional derivatives of the action and the stress energy components. Let me just also remind you that whenever we encounter time derivatives in canonical formalism, we use a Poisson bracket. Here, H total stands for the total Hamiltonian constraint. It's a bit, I abuse the letter H. So H with two arguments stands for the total Hamiltonian constraint, where this just stands for the one related to time shift. And total means that I include both matter and gravity. And as you saw yesterday several times, these constraints satisfy the following constraint algebra. Okay, so now we can rewrite the energy conservation equation in terms of canonical variables. So I'm not putting this to bore you, just we'll talk how quantum corrections come in here. So the second line is just this term, and all the other terms follow from here. So far, I have not used constraint algebra, but as you see this term, this is a time derivative, so we have to use constraint algebra. For example, this is Alea Jurek's notation, with C standing for the total Hamiltonian constraint density. So that contains both H and D, whose time derivatives can be computed as follows. And we'll also need the time derivative of the spatial metric. So the good news here is that if you substitute these all expressions in here, you get a zero. it's not obvious, but yeah, if you do all that, it is zero. So it's good news that indeed we can translate covariant form of energy conservation into canonical form, and that still works. So now we can talk about what would happen if we include the quantum corrections. And again, let me go to this slide with constraint algebra. As a few people yesterday pointed out, the most typical expected correction comes in the last equation, the first order unaffected. But in the last equation, there is a beta factor, a quantum correction. So that will appear in this term. And now we need to think, what can we do to actually compensate for this extra term that comes out of the time derivative? And we've tried a few things. For example, the first intention is to change something on the right-hand side to still have it equal zero. And one possibility is to add a tensor to the gamma, the connection gamma, to the component of gamma that's responsible for this term in here, to the time derivative of lapse. And that could do the trick. So if we also modify some components of gamma, that could do the trick and still cancel the right-hand side. But then if we change some components of gamma but don't change the others, that would break the covariant form of the energy conservation. And you could try a few things. And you see it usually leads to inconsistencies. Always leads to inconsistencies, at least in the cases we tried. And then you may want to reconsider, OK, maybe we should change the form of energy conservation to incorporate quantum corrections. So basically, all these attempts were not successful. And I think there is a good reason for that, and reasons which I'm going to summarize on the next slide. So when we switch to canonical formalism, and especially include quantum corrections, the space-time transformations are now generated by constraints. And that will affect, if you want to translate back to covariant language, it's not clear how to handle standard tensor algebra, because again, transformations are dictated by constraints. We can't use form metric anymore. Well, at least we can form an invariant line element for the reason above. And we can't use covariant form of energy conservation, again, for similar reasons. On the bright side, we can proceed purely canonically. We can actually define the statement of conservation of energy as equivalent statement to closure of constraint algebra. If constraint algebra is closed, that ensures both that you don't have anomalies and you can actually formulate your equations of motion in terms of gauge invariant variables. We can define energy density as a combination of constraints, and again, constraint algebra would ensure the, you know, corresponding conservations. And this should be potentially fruitful for cosmology, where we need to define energy density, pressure, curvature perturbations, and so on. Thank you.
Some questions. I think one has to draw a distinction between two things, right? I mean, one is what one can do and what can be done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like what one can do is a statement about one's abilities, and from there one cannot draw blanket conclusions about something cannot be done whatsoever. So if you go back to sort of what you like right in the beginning, I think it was third transparency already there, one of the first transparencies that we had.
Here.
So you say gauge cannot be fixed prior to quantization. You say you cannot quantize matter without quantizing space-time. I mean, if you tell that to people doing quantum field theory in curved space-times, they would just laugh at us, right?
Well, they consider regimes when quantum corrections are not as important for space-time. So beta would
they consider semi-classical gravity. People actually do. For example, semi-classical gravity, in which one calculates in great detail the back reaction of the Hawking evaporation process, where one is using quantum space-time, I mean quantum matter, and one is actually correcting the classical metric with H-bar corrections using semi-classical methods.
Mm-hmm.
I think that these are extremely strong statements, and gauge cannot be fixed prior to quantization. I mean, people do it all the time in gauge theories, people do it.
This may be a strong statement. So let me make a more cautious statement. When you quantize in general, and especially when you fix gauge prior to quantization, you need to check if the resulting constrained algebra is closed. So when you fix gauge, you don't have control on the constrained algebra anymore, because you're getting rid of certain constraints. So
it's a very systematic procedure. It was started with Dirac and Feynman and Pop and Fadiev and Popov and various people. I mean, it's not a yesterday story. You know, right? It's a very systematic procedure to do this. I just felt that these are just very sweeping statements that were being made in the beginning, and also the conclusion about that one cannot have a space-time covariant conservation of scarcity tensor. Again, people who do back reaction to Hawking radiation or quantum field theory in curved space-time, they have a stress energy tensor, and it is actually conserved, and it is a space-time statement. There's no problem.
Well, there are certain things that become unclear when you have quantum corrections. When you, for example, so again, when we talk about tensorial structure and space-time transformations, they're dictated by constraint, and with quantum corrections, they're certainly different from those transformations in classical case. And then it's not even clear how you define integrated forms of energy conservation. Let's say you integrate over hypersurface and for space-time.
That's exactly what these people do. They actually show that the change of the mass of the area of the horizon is equal to, is related to the Bondi flux at infinity. That's exactly that. And that is using grad mu of t mu nu, quantum mechanical, is equal to zero.
I don't want to continue too much. I just wanted to say that.
We should certainly talk more.
This is a statement about, I do this, I do this, I do this, and then I get stuck, therefore I cannot do this. From there, one cannot draw conclusions of what.
These conclusions, they're inspired by what we couldn't do, but they're not consequences of, yeah.
Okay, so, so let's thank Mike again. Mm-hmm. Move on to the next talk.
Would you have time to talk?
Sure.
Thank you very much. I would like also to thank the organizers for allowing me to give this talk about my recent work, and a joint work with Emanuele Alecci and Professor Randowski. And the object of our work is to define a new operator for LQG, what we call the quantum ratio operator corresponding to the curvature that was shown in the previous talk. So the plan of my talk will be the following. I will present the motivation, introduce the classical theory that we use, and go on the, with the, contrast, the construction of the operator, and present some properties. So the motivation that we know is that in the classical level, the Hamiltonian constraint, the Lorentzian case, is written in this has this form, where this part is what we call the Euclidean part, and we have this additional term here. So our goal now is to try to implement this Hamiltonian constraint in a new, different way. Therefore, we need to define an operator corresponding to this term. So the basic idea in our construction is to use Regge calculus, classical formulas, to regulate this expression. So let me introduce Regge calculus briefly. So having an n-dimensional Riemannian manifold, we can introduce a decomposition of this manifold and consider that the curvature lies only on the hinges. Therefore, we can rewrite an action for this decomposition, which approximates the Einstein-Hilbert action, explaining the following. Where here, those epsilon I are what we call the deficit angles, and the VI are usually the measure of the n-2 volume. In the case of three dimensions, which is the case that we have for the Hamiltonian, the action can be expressed only in terms of the length. In fact, written like that, we have a sum over all the hinges, length times the deficit angle, where this deficit angle, in the case of triangulation, which is in the considered case in Regge, they are just functions of the length. The lengths here are basically the fundamental variables. This action can be rewritten in a different way, which is the form that we choose and which we think is more suitable for the quantization here, where we sum, instead of summing over the hinges, we sum over simplexes that we have, and then we sum over the hinges belonging to the simplex, the length, and this alpha here, this parameter, which is stands for the number of simplexes sharing one hinge. And the theta i's here are the dihedral angle represented here. For our purposes, we need more than triangulations, as we will see in the construction. Therefore, we need to generalize, to see how can we generalize this action to piecewise flat serial decomposition, and defined in such a way, where this is a serial decomposition. It's just disjoint union of open sets defined in such a way. And in fact, when it's easy to notice that the same expression holds for arbitrary pessimals. What I mean by same expression is the same expression for Regge action, which is reduced just to the sum again over the hinges of length time deficit angle. But here, it's important to notice that this deficit angle doesn't depend anymore on the length, because in this case, the lengths are not the basic variables anymore. But for us, in our concept, we are always interested only in this function. We are not interested in deriving any equation of motions. What about the convergence? We would say that Regge calculus approximates GR.
In fact, this was proven for triangulations and more general lattices in a paper in the 80s by Friedberg and Lee. What they show, in fact, that this action in converges when we consider a typical length of the decomposition. This convergence, in fact, can also be generalized to this case. We don't have any more those, in the case of 3D, we don't have any more those straight hinges, but curved. The action still has the same expression, and the convergence can be proved at least for one class. Now I move to the construction. So what we want to do is define such an operator. The classical, therefore, we need to define operators corresponding to the quantities that we had here, which is the length and the angle. The classical expression that we have usually are written in this way. In terms, here the length is written as an integral over the curve, where the expression is in terms of the densitized triads. The angle also can be expressed in terms of those variables. Then we go to matching Ricci calculus context with LQG framework. To do that, we invoke the dual picture of LQG. How? Then for each spin network graph that we will consider, we'll associate a cellular decomposition that we call a covariance decomposition. This decomposition is defined in this way, that each tree cell of the decomposition contains at most one vertex. Each two cell is punctured at most by one edge of the graph, and its intersection belongs to the interior of the edge. And two tree cells of the entire group, such that the identified two cells match. We also need to put an additional requirement. This is basically a requirement needed to define the length operator, the construction. As we see, the length operator is an operator which was already defined in the context of LQG. So here it is. The length operator is, since we are considering our construction, we are taking seriously the dual picture of LQG. We chose to use the Bianchi length operator, which I present the construction now. This length operator measures the length. If you consider two surfaces dual to two links intersecting in some curve gamma, this length operator that will be defined is basically measuring the length of this curve. So the starting point in the construction of this operator, starting from those classical expressions, then we rewrite those the expression as a Riemannian sum. We develop those functions here, delta, as integrals over the surfaces of the partition. Here we introduce those functions here, v and t, and in fact, they are to ensure the SU2 invariance. Then we rewrite the surface integrals in the function as Riemann sum again. And this time we express it in terms of the fluxes, where the fluxes are defined as just the integrals over the surfaces. And we get the final operator defined this way, where we use the flux operators that we define. A subtle point here is that this expression here in the denominator is just the volume. But in LQG, we have, of course, a volume operator. But here we need the inverse. And to define that, we use a usual trick, I would say, to define an inverse operator of the volume, where we require just that the eigenvalues are the inverse of the eigenvalues of the operator, and that when the eigenvalue of the volume is zero, also the inverse is zero. So at the end, we end up with an operator which is associated to a wedge, where the wedge is defined just as two links intersecting one node of the graph. And we choose an ordering has to be chosen. And this is the final expression. Now, for the deficit angle, we proceed with the same scheme to regularize the classical expression. And the final expression classically is written like that. With this part is just the expression again of the function ensuring the SU2 invariance and the fluxes. This operator, after using the flux operators, can be is diagonal, in fact, in the intertwiner basis. So it's it has a very easy expression. So now we move to the Ricci operator. This operator, if we consider the simple case that we have just two surfaces dual to a wedge, and we have an intersection along a curve gamma, that what we wanted to do is to define an operator corresponding to the classical expression. And now we have an operator corresponding to each quantity here. We had to choose, of course, an ordering here to ensure also the operator to be Hermitian. And we get this final expression. Well, alpha here conserved the, basically on the quantum level, may conserve the same interpretation. At the end, we get an operator defined here when we sum now over the cells, since we consider general decompositions, where we have a sum over the cells, sum over the segments that we get of the lengths, and the angle operators. So this operator is Hermitian, but depends on the choice of the decomposition. We can also define an operator representing the action of this one in a small region contained in it, just restrained to one tree cell of the decomposition. It can be defined in this way. And the action of this operator on cylindrical functions gives zero unless the tree cell contains a node. Therefore, the final action of the operator R delta can be written in the following way, where we introduce this coefficient kappa. And this kappa is just taking into account what wedges are selected by the decomposition. It takes one when this wedge is defined by the cell, and zero when it's not. So the action, of course, depends on the tree cells contained in the nodes in terms of this coefficient, but also on the cells glued to them. And it's translated in terms of this coefficient alpha. However, the limit is well defined as we shrink delta, in the sense that since we also need, as in the classical level, we have this limit that we have a function which is Ricci action approximating the classical Einstein-Hilbert action. So we have a limit, and we have to take the limit. And therefore, it's expressed here. But it doesn't change anything, because at the end, it's reduced to just to a sum over the nodes belonging to the graph and a sum over the wedges selected by this decomposition that we choose. So at this level, this operator still carries a memory of the choice of the covering decomposition, of course. So first, in this kappa, and we chose to solve it using an averaging procedure that I will present. Then alpha, which is a free parameter here at this point. So dependence on kappa, as I said, arises directly from the choice of the three cells of delta containing the nodes. But it's important to notice that in the definition that we gave for the decomposition, each tree cell is isomorphic to a spherical polyhedra, where I find this requirement that the intersection of two faces is connected. What do we mean by isomorphic? Isomorphic is the fact that you have a bijective regular celeron map. Celeron maps are just the mapping CW complexes to another CW complexes. But we require this isomorphism because it ensures that you are mapping, if you consider two cells, you are mapping vertices to vertices, segment to segments, faces to faces. The important point is that those spherical polyhedra regroup in finite number of classes. And each class defines, in fact, a different configuration. So therefore, the number of inequivalent configurations is always finite, as the number of classes is finite. So this allows us to define an averaging procedure over the different configuration that we have associated to one tree cell. Here I give an example in the case of a cell with four faces. So at the end, we have only three classes, as you see, the four hosahedron, the class with three vertices, and spherical tetrahedra. So a wedge belonging to gamma-containing node has a number of appearances, because if you focus on one node with n valence and you put a cell around it, each time you are selecting a set of wedges, not all of them, but a set. But it might happen that you have sometimes you are selecting a wedge in a configuration or in a set of configurations, in others not. Therefore, it has a number of appearances in the full set of configurations. Thus, we can define a coefficient kappa, which depends only on the valence of the node, defined in this way. therefore, at the end, we can define an average operator acting on cylinder functions in this way, where this kappa now stands for the average of the coefficient kappa introduced before in the operator r theta. And it ensures that now this operator doesn't depend anymore on any decomposition, on any choice. Just the sum is reduced when we have, at the beginning, two sums. Now the sum reduces just that you are summing over all the wedges defined by the graph. Now, the second ambiguity is on the coefficients alpha. In the construction that we introduced, or if you go back even to the classical level, alpha is just the number of cells sharing one segment that we consider. So in our construction, we still didn't put any prescription to how fix this alpha. So at this level, it's still totally arbitrary. In fact, we can make any choice of prescription, and it's also important because this alpha could control some properties of this operator. Basically, for example, the locality of the operator in this sense. Now I go to the properties. So at the end, this Ricci operator that we defined, this SU2 gauge invariant, the fuel-morphism invariant, has a discrete spectrum, as we have presented here. Here is the case of a simple configuration where we have just a four-valent node. Here is the this case here that we see three nodes connected with equal spins, and also we tested this operator on semi-classical state. In the first case, when we have a four-valent node, we see a behavior which is in fact quite good because it corresponds exactly to what we expect classically, in the sense that when we vary the spin here, which is here, the curvature that we compute will evolve as square root of the area which is we have, and the spin is exactly the area in this case. Here, in this case, is the we focus on this configuration. We chose, in fact, a configuration which corresponds classically to a flat case. We have zero curvature inside, and we can see exactly that we have a tendency, the kind of convergence of the expectation values to zero compared, for example, to this case. So to summarize, we started. Our goal was to define an operator corresponding to the non-Euclidean part in the Hamiltonian constraint, and we used Regge calculus to regularize the classical expression, and we ended up with an operator which has very nice properties described here. It's Hermitian. An important point also, it's not graph changing. It's Gaussian invariant and diffeomorphic invariant, has a discrete spectrum. And eigenstates, eigenvalues can be computed algebraically and numerically. And as far as we tested up now, it has the appropriate semi-classical behavior on states because on classical geometry. And that's all. Thank you for your attention.
Correctly, by wedge you mean
that
two edges they share, two dual edges they share one vertex.
A wedge is on the graph. It's a spin network graph. So two links sharing one node. So.
I see. So not on the dual picture.
No.
I see. So you don't need to know what is the reconstruction of the.
No, not at all. That's why we use the average procedure. It's to remove any information about the decomposition that we chose.
And can you explain a little more the final graph you had?
This one?
So you're varying what? That's the spin of the.
Yes, that's the. If you go to the figure here, that's this internal spin here, which considered to be equal. So here I consider it equal. It's a simple configuration. It's picked around.
And external spins are fixed.
Yes.
So classically, as you vary.
Well, fixed, not really fixed, because they are constrained. But since we picked on a classical configuration, they are constrained by the classical configuration. They also depend kind of on J. There is a restriction on them by the value of J.
Yeah.
But the constraint comes from the fact if you consider three tetrahedra glued. Yeah, so if you consider three tetrahedra glued, you cannot keep changing J as you want. Because if you change J, get it bigger, you have to change also this J prime.
Well, you could say that as you change classically, mm-hmm. you change the J inside, you're inducing curvature of the values. And I thought that's what you were testing with your operator.
I'm changing curvature, yeah.
And your operator is seeing it in a way that seems to be consistent with this elastic limit. Was that
Yeah. Just a very quick clarification question.
Yeah.
You have the, you don't have an operator, right? Because you've got this arbitrary alpha I.
True.
Because they depend on the. So in these examples, you just fix that arbitrarily, or you?
No, it's fixed according to a prescription that we chose, in the sense that we say, OK, for example, here we consider that alpha is equal to 3. In the sense that we take the closer the closest neighborhood
to this. So the graph is determining the cellular decomposition, is it? I mean, you're using something?
Okay, the graph, not totally. There is a degree of freedom, which is in this way.
Quick question, so it's not cylindrical consistent?
No, not at all, but unfortunately.
Reason why you are happy to
say I can't be happy with that. But well, we were hoping that at some point that this coefficient alpha could help us to cancel any coefficient which would come for any avergent procedure. We still didn't work deeply on that, but for now, yes, we have to do it with like that. With cylindrically, it's not cylindrically consistent.
Okay. So let's say maybe again.
Thank you.
Speak about geometric observables.
Yes, hello. I would like to present some scheme of defining geometrical observables for vacuum GR and GR coupled to a dust field. I will report on results which I obtained with Paweł Duch, Wojtek Kamiński, and Professor Lewandowski. So first I'll show some previous ideas of how to define observables, and just to give you a perspective of where our construction fits. Next, I will recall the well-known construction of Fermi coordinates. And then having those coordinates, I will define observables for the vacuum case. And then for some reason, which I'll underline, I will move to the case of GR coupled to dust. So as we all know, in general relativity, when we want to describe some physical quantities, we need diffeomorphism invariant observables. And the problem of defining them is quite hard. There were many attempts. They all have some problems. And the general strategy which we will follow is the following. First, you can define or get from somewhere some physical coordinates which are properly gauge covariant or diffeomorphism covariant. And then when you express some quantity which is some function of the metric in those coordinates, you obtain a gauge invariant observable. So this idea was used, for example, by Bergman and Komar when they used the coordinates they defined were built from curvature scalars. So they proved that in n-dimensional spacetime, you can define n-independent scalars, which were constructed from curvature and its derivatives. And then specifying the values of those scalars, you can specify a point at which those scalars assume those values. The problem is that this construction works only when spacetime is totally non-regular. By that I mean that it possesses no local symmetries, because otherwise you don't single out a point specifying the values of those scalars. Another idea, which is in some sense similar, is but on the other hand is on on the opposite side, is the idea of, for example, Brown and Kuhasz to study some matter fields. And with those matter fields, get the coordinates. So for example, in this work, they use dust fields. And you have some fields which fill the spacetime. Specifying the value of those fields, you specify a point at which those values are assumed. The last idea, which is closest to what I will present next, is the idea introduced by Professor Rovelli of GPS satellites. In this approach, you have a minimal amount of matter, and these are the four world lines here, which are interpreted as GPS satellites. And they carry some clocks, which measure their proper time. And to give coordinates to a given point, you check which four signals emanated from the world lines of the satellites this point hears. In the sense that, for example, if you look at this world line, you see that the signal emitted from this point reaches this point to which we want to assign coordinates. So we assign to it this time reading. And now, so the coordinates given to this point are the four clock readings at the tips of the cones. Now, in our construction, we will use just one world line. This world line will represent the observer. So let's take a world line gamma. Now, we have the four velocity of this observer. And we need to choose a frame ej, where j runs through x, y, z, of vectors orthogonal to the four velocity v. Then for every point gamma of S0, where S0 measures the proper time of this observer, we want to have a frame. We obtain it from this chosen frame by parallelly transporting it along this world line. So we have a preferred frame here. Now we take a linear combination of those vectors with parameters Sj. So again, these are three parameters. And we have some spatial vector. Some spatial vector. Now we check. We take such a geodesic, which crosses through the point gamma of S0 with the tangent vector equal to the vector we constructed. And we go along this geodesic for proper distance equal to the length of this vector. And we reach some point. This is the point x to which we assign coordinates. So how does it work? Well, mathematically, what we do is I define a Fermi parameterization f, which takes those four parameters, so the proper time and the components of the vector. And then it singles out the point x in such a way, using the exponent map, which maps from the tangent space at this point to the manifold. Now, notice that to be able to single out the point, we didn't need only the parameters, but we also needed the world line of the observer and the frame. So this is some fixed structure which we need to be able to define those coordinates. And we also used those coordinates depend on the metric. This is obviously because we used geodesics, or the exponent map. Now, this dependence on the metric is crucial, because this is what makes our coordinates covariant. And then they are suitable for defining observables. Of course, those coordinates have a limited range of validity. You cannot parameterize an arbitrary spacetime in such a way. Usually, those coordinates break down at some point. And however, you can prove that there always exists a tubular neighborhood of this world line, which can be parameterized in this way. And I want to underline that a nice feature of this construction is that when does this coordinate, what limits the validity? Well, obviously, the problems appear when the geodesics start to cross. And they start to cross and this is controlled by the curvature of geometry. So the more regular, in the sense that the flatter the spacetime is, the wider the range of the coordinates. In Minkowski spacetime, for example, these coordinates are global. And you can see that they are just the inertial coordinates assigned to inertial observer. And actually, you can also make it more make more mathematically strict the statement that these coordinates are a very natural generalization of inertial coordinates or observers. I can justify that if you're interested later. Now, having the coordinates, we can turn to observables. So what we do, for any function of the metric, we consider its pullback by the Fermi parameterization I just defined. And this the resulting function is a Dirac observable, or gauge is diffeomorphism invariant, if you want. For example, if we have the inverse metric, we associate to it an observable O. This is, by the way, using the relational observables notation. So the observable associated to the inverse metric by the with the use of parametrization F is given by the pullback of the inverse metric evaluated at point X such that the Fermi parametrization for those parameters gives us the point X. Now, we have the observables. What can we do? Well, we can start to use them. But to use them, we need their Poisson brackets. It turns out that, one step back. To be able to compute Poisson brackets, we need to introduce the whole canonical formalism. We can do that here quite naturally using the defining the Cauchy surfaces to be the surfaces of constant Fermi time. And this has some nice features, which I'll describe in a second. However, it turns out that if we do that, the Poisson brackets for two generic observables constructed in this way are not well defined. And this is due to the fact that the observables depend on the metric singularly. I mean, they depend singularly on the value of the metric at the world line of the observer. And although this singularity is controllable when you speak about a single observable, when you want to compute their Poisson brackets, you have to multiply two variations of observables with respect to the canonical data. And this poses problems, and it makes the Poisson bracket ill-defined. One could, of course, try to regularize this Poisson bracket, but this is not the route we followed. What we did is we realized that while studying this approach, that if we define spherical Fermi coordinates, which are related to the previous ones by the usual transformation, then the canonical data assumes those nice values. So, the simplicity of those conditions, I would say, motivated us to look at them as gauge fixing conditions. And then, when we did that, we noticed that the problems with the Poisson brackets boils down to comes from the fact that the first condition and the last one do not Poisson commute. So we thought about the possibility of considering such a model in which the last condition won't appear. And this turns out to be the case if we consider gravity coupled to a scalar field. We considered specifically the irrotational dust field, which is just gravity. So we coupled to gravity the irrotational dust. It turns out that if we perform the 3+1 decomposition and choose the time gauge, then this theory can be deparametrized with the use of the dust field. And one ends up with an action where the free variable is, the free variable is the spatial metric. There is its momentum. There is the Hamiltonian. There is a real non-vanishing Hamiltonian in the theory. And there is still the spatial diffeomorphism gauge freedom. Now, having this theory, we worked out a similar construction. So we imposed gauge fixing constraints in this form. So the BKs are the constraints which we add to the theory. And they, as you can see, fix the the radial components of the spatial metric to be equal to delta, just like we wanted. Now, for any observable O, so for any functional on the phase space, we take its extension. I call it
K is a smearing function.
Yes, K is a smearing vector. It's just we just prefer to work with smearing vector fields. It's for some reason more tractable, I would say. So K is just a smearing vector field. Now, we extend this. We extend this O for any observable. We extend it off the constraint surface, adding some terms proportional to the vector constraints and the gauge fixing constraints, where NO and KO fields are chosen in such a way that the extended observable Poisson commutes with all the constraints present in the theory. These conditions turn out to be some quite lengthy partial differential equations for NO and KO. However, remarkably, they separate. So the equations for NO are separate from the equations for KO. And one can even solve them, those equations explicitly, write down their solutions, understand everything about them. So this means that for an observable O, we can explicitly write down the Dirac observable, which is gauge invariant, associated to this O. Now, having a gauge invariant observable, we can, for example, find its evolution. I remind you that in this theory we consider now, we have a real Hamiltonian. So the, it turns out that the time derivative of the extended observable differs from the time derivative of the observable someone gave us, to which we constructed the extension, just by a term, well, this term where KO are determined by these two conditions. Now, it seems that everything is fine. We constructed observables and we're done. But the problem is that I lied a bit, because I said a couple of times that they are gauge invariant, so that they are diffeomorphism invariant. Well, they are, but they are invariant only under a large class of diffeomorphisms. The problem is that we needed some fixed structure to define my coordinates, the Fermi coordinates. So we needed the world line of the observer and the frame. And this turns out to limit the gauge freedom we fixed. Our observables are invariant under almost all diffeomorphisms, but for a finite set of them. In the case of vacuum GR, there is a 10-dimensional space of diffeomorphism, which you can understand as the Poincaré transformations. I mean, you can link them to the Poincaré transformations acting on the structure we fixed. And in the case of GR coupled to the dust, there are six such transformations related to the spatial translations and rotations of the observer and his frame. So to summarize, I presented a new scheme of obtaining partial and almost complete observables for vacuum GR and GR coupled to rotational dust. And now I would like to comment a bit on the outlook in the last word. So one possible way to proceed now is to turn this world line of the observer, I mean the observer and his directions or the frame he carries, dynamical. So to add, for example, some matter to the theory which will represent this observer, and hence we will get rid of this problem of the residual gauge freedom. We did some research in that direction, however, none of the results proved to be like, okay, there are some problems with each of the attempts we tried. However, there is another nice feature of this construction, which I call the reduced phase space approach. Notice that in the case of GR coupled to the dust, what we have is the spatial metric. Now, as you all know, it has three independent components. We gauge fixed three of them to be equal to delta. So we are left with three. But how many degrees of freedom do we have in our theory? We have two per point for gravity, plus one because of the presence of the dust, or the scalar field. So it means that we have three components left and 3 degrees of freedom. Well, obviously, I didn't say anything in the case of rotational dust about the momentum. So there are, again, there are six more independent components of the momentum. However, we still have the diffeomorphism constraint. And it turns out that we can solve the diffeomorphism constraint for those three components and express them in terms of the tangential components of the spatial metric and the tangential components of the momentum. So it seems that we will be able to obtain a description of gravity coupled to dust in terms of 2 degrees of freedom, where no gauge will be present anymore. True degrees of freedom. Yeah. Three true physical degrees of freedom. However, I do not comment more on these results because there are some mathematical issues with the point where the observer is, which we didn't fix totally yet. And thank you. That is all.
I think if you consider scalar field observables, complete observables built from scalar fields, you also have the same thing, that actually the observables are already invariant under almost all constraints, and only 4 remain. So this is, and that follows almost automatically. It's a similar mechanism.
Yes, there are some differences. So the difference is that in our case, these observables have a very natural physical interpretation. Yes, but the problem with the scalar field is that the scalar fields would have to exist.
Yeah, here's the observer has to exist.
Okay, yes. I use the dust, I agree, but
you have to couple the observer in principle, what you're not doing. You have to couple the observer in principle to get some fully gauge invariant, I think, at the end.
Yes, that's what I said. I mean, I would have to complete it to be.
So it was exactly the aim of this
project that we know perfectly well how to deparameterize space by using some matter. But the idea was, can perhaps space be deparameterized by using geometry, as which is in the spirit of geometric approach of general relativity.
Yeah.
So the idea was to parameterize space exactly by distances and angles rather than by four scalars.
But you don't couple them dynamically to the system.
Yes. For instance, there is this observer, which we don't know how to couple because there is.
But
no
the distances are
coupling of point particles with gravity because of the self interaction.
No.
But assuming that observers exist.
But this is usually the final point for the scalar field. You know, the complicated point is to compute the complete observers with respect to the four remaining constraints. For that, you have to solve. Kind of the thing. Okay. Other questions?
These constructions are all these constructions are very nice, but I mean, they're so complicated that. I can't imagine using them in quantum theory, at least with my finite abilities. Maybe that's my sort of. There's always a tension. Right? You start doing something which is nice and geometrical classically, but then it becomes so complicated because you have to do explanation map, you have to solve geodesic equations, and so on. So how this can be taken to quantum theory becomes then.
Probably this is why this is not so often used, this approach, but. But, so either something is very well motivated or something is very easy. So in this case, it is well motivated, but apparently life is not so easy.
Okay, I mean, to comment to Amaris, that you in principle could try to construct gauge environment observers by Hubert aging, which would be related to these things, but it's of course also hard.
But it just seems very hard to construct those. I mean, I agree in principle.
But polynomial is
not. I mean, okay, this is where I want to be. The question is, are we making our life harder? I mean, classically, we already have so much trouble doing everything in a diffeomorphism invariant manner. People in other areas often just fix gauge, right? I mean, even QCD, the proofs of constructive QCD, they often just fix gauge. So should we just try to fix gauge using matter fields.
I would say that's exactly what I do. I try to fix gauge. However, I try to make it as intuitive. I mean, I try to find such a gauge fixing, which is very intuitive, right? I mean, it really resembles the guy who sits there and describes the world around him. So that's just some motivation for it. I mean, a specific gauge choice, which has some modifications. Plus, it has this nice feature that the components of the metric are very simple in this gauge. So it is also, in some respect, obviously, to some limited extent, it is simple.
But couldn't I just forget about the whole construction and say, consider the gauge in which the components
of
the metric are just this?
Yes, of course. But then the question is, how would you reconstruct the spacetime from such thing? And to that, you need to have this intuition, I mean, or some story to tell. How do you go from the full, not unfixed to the fixed version?
Okay, so let's go for coffee.